Good afternoon. My name is Lucas Hickson, and as Dave mentioned, I'm a field engineer, and I specialize in detecting and tracking radioactive materials as they travel through the environment. Naturally, my work takes me to contaminated sites across the world. I have published peer-reviewed studies monitoring the spread of this contamination. I've sampled at over 50 contaminated sites here in the United States, including some here in Illinois. I would like to start first by thanking NEIS and Dave Kraft for hosting this event. I would also like to thank DePaul University for providing the space for us here today to meet. And I also want to thank Dr. Fields for coming up and talking later about Fukushima. This last September, just a few short months ago, I had the opportunity to travel to the Chernobyl nuclear power plant as part of a first-of-its-kind vocational training program. I had the opportunity to live in the worker town of Slavutich and take the train to the power plant every day with them. While I was at the plant, I had the unique opportunity to speak with the workers and the supervisors of the different programs that are taking place and really get a first-person understanding of some of the difficulties and complications of their remediation activities. And that's some of the things that I want to explain with you today. It's still very hard for me to believe that 30 years after the disaster, the Chernobyl nuclear power plant still requires assistance with decommissioning, fuel recovery, and remediation activities. I want to talk to you today about the accident. We're going to touch on the construction of the sarcophagus, and we will also discuss the lives and activities of the workers who are working on the current projects at the nuclear power plant. Until the nuclear disaster in Japan in 2011, Chernobyl was widely heralded as the worst man-made disaster in history. Even now, 30 years later, workers are still working just to mitigate the consequences, not to clean up, not to bring it back to its original pristine condition, just to lessen the consequences of this disaster. Chicago is inextricably linked to nuclear power. The world's first sustained nuclear reaction took place here under the oversight of Enrico Fermi in 1942. The state of Illinois hosts 11 reactors at 6 nuclear power stations. If it were its own country, it would be the 13th largest producer of nuclear power in the world. So I think it is important that we talk about events like Fukushima Daiichi and Chernobyl. First, I'd like you to get a little bit more familiar with the plant with me. The Chernobyl nuclear power plant is located 80 to 90 miles from Kiev, which is the capital, and that's about a quarter of the distance from here to Detroit. During the 1970s, when the Soviet Union was in a period of rapid growth and development of commercial nuclear power, a common slogan that would be heard is "a peaceful atom in every house." This slogan obviously became less positive and more menacing after the disaster at Chernobyl. There are a few interesting facts about the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. The first is that it actually was never called the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. It was the Lenin nuclear power plant, and it was misreported during some of the initial reports here in the U.S. as there's limited information coming out of the Soviet Union at the time, and that name has stuck ever since. But the plant was sited in the late 60s. Construction began in the 70s, and that's about the time that the operation started there in 1977. There are four operating reactors at the site. You have Unit 1, Unit 2, Unit 3, and Unit 4. Down here on the end is the administration buildings. This is the big turbine building. It is one large unit, and all of the different turbines for those reactors are in here. And then in between the turbine building and the reactor buildings right here is the deaerator corridor, and this is the main path that workers would take as they come on site. They check in down here at the administration building and then walk down this corridor, and we'll talk more about why that corridor is important. The Unit 3 reactor is actually only 120 yards away from the Unit 4 reactor, and there were some complications from that disaster that affected the operations at Unit 3, and again, we will talk about that. Next to the reactor blocks, we have the administration buildings. Up over here, we have a spent fuel facility, but this is the construction pad right here for the new confinement structure, which we will be moving in place over the sarcophagus. At the time of the accident, there were two other additional reactors, Units 5 and Unit 6, down over here on the island. which were under construction and were actually never completed because they were so heavily affected by the radioactive materials that were released. But the Unit 4 reactor is not the only reactor on site that's been shut down due to an accident or meltdown. The Unit 2 reactor has been offline since a fire in 1991 that damaged critical safety equipment, and there was actually a partial core meltdown at the Unit 1 reactor in 1982. On April 26, 1986, the Unit 4 reactor was crippled by a series of explosions that destroyed the reactor building and spewed radioactive materials into the environment. The fires on the site continued for 11 days. And on that warm spring night, the operators were running an experiment, which Dave alluded to earlier. During this experiment, the operators had difficulty maintaining the power levels in the reactor. The reactor power dipped below 30 megawatts and fell into what they call as the iodine pit, which is you have these daughter products that are preventing the neutrons from forming and multiplying and allowing you to continue operating the reactor. The reactor was entering dangerous waters when this happened, and it was becoming more difficult to control. If the operators had failed to complete the test that night, it was just determined that they probably would not be able to repeat it for at least a year. So there was a lot of pressure on them to continue carrying out the operations no matter what was happening with the reactor itself. Three of the operators in the control room attempted to manually operate the reactor by adjusting the steam pressure and water levels, but they were unable to prevent the water inside the reactor from boiling and steam from being generated, which affected the way that the reactor was operating, and it led to a surge in power inside of the reactor. When the operators noticed that the power was surging, they hit what was called the AZ button, which is a scram button, which would insert the control rods into the reactor and stop the reaction that was taking place. No one in the room could have guessed in their wildest dreams what would have happened when they pushed that button and what the events would be set into motion. But after the button was pressed, the reactivity in the reactor accelerated out of control, leading to a prompt neutron surge that completely destroyed the reactor. The control rods, which help the operators control the reaction in the reactor, were graphite-tipped. And when they began to insert, they actually displaced some of the coolant water, which was inside of the reactor, but they were not inserted far enough to slow down the multiplication of neutrons. So essentially what they did is they pushed out some of the water, which was helping to moderate that reaction without actually adding any benefit. When the operators realized that the control rods had not fully inserted, they began attempting any alternative method that they could think of to try and get the control rods inserted into the reactor. But all of these efforts were unsuccessful. Some of these operators, like many other of the emergency responders that night, would later die from the radiation exposures that they received. When the tips of the control rod displaced that coolant water, combined with the rising temperatures inside of the reactor and the lack of enough absorbing rods, these control rods, to slow the multiplication of neutrons, the reactor ran out of control. Inside of the reactor, the water levels continued to drop and massive amounts of steam began to form. This allowed the fuel assemblies to begin to fail, and the fuel channels, which actually hold these fuel assemblies in place, began to fall apart. The pressure inside of the reactor increased by 15 atmospheres per second, which prevented the additional flow of water into the reactor. The reactor, instead of water, began to fill up with a mixture of radioactive gases, including hydrogen and oxygen. And within a few seconds, the powerful explosions completely crippled the reactor, destroyed the reactor building, and spread contamination around the site. Popular analogy is that it's like a vehicle traveling down the road at about 60 miles an hour, and you're approaching a stop sign. They were going to be shutting down the reactor, and when you hit the brakes on the car, instead of the car deaccelerating, it instead speeds up till it blows up. That's essentially what happened at Chernobyl. They attempted to hit the brakes, the reaction ran out of control, and it blew up. The operators would die that night from the exposures without knowing exactly why the reactor blew up. Only after the accident would it be discovered that the flaw that caused this power surge was known to the designers and some of the senior technical staff but this had never been communicated to the operators of these reactors. The explosion that night destroyed the reactor building, ripped through all of the protection barriers, and overcame all of the safety systems. It also damaged portions of the adjacent buildings, like the turbine buildings, the administrational buildings, the Unit 3 reactor building, and it left fires spread across the site. The following is a quote from Gian Petrov, who at the time was an equipment manager that supplied components to nuclear power plants in the region. On that night, he was actually driving back to Pripyat with his son at about 2:30 in the morning, which is about an hour after the accident. While approaching the city, Petrov said that he could see the fires above the Unit 4 reactor, and this is a quote from him. The ventilation stack, with its horizontal red stripes, was clearly lit up by the flames. I remember how the flames were higher than the shaft, so that meant they must have been nearly 600 feet in the air. Instead of turning to go home, I decided to go closer to the number 4 unit to get a better look. By the light of the fire, I could see that the building was half destroyed. It was a terrible sight. I stood there about a minute, feeling a strangely oppressive sense of alarm, of numbness. Everything that I saw was imprinted on my memory for the rest of my life. I could clearly see the flames on the roofs of the turbine hall and the deaerator, and I could see the firefighters. One of these firefighters climbed onto the roof of the block. Now, sometime later, I realize he was the first person in the history of mankind to be exposed to that kind of danger. Even at Hiroshima, there was no one who got that close to the nuclear explosion. At his feet, the crater of a nuclear volcano was emitting 30,000 Rontgen per hour. Before the disaster, to kind of help put that number into perspective, it would have been unheard of for the average nuclear industry worker to be exposed to more than 5 Rontgen during an entire year of normal operations. And the specialists that go into the high radiation areas would generally only receive 10 to 15 Rontgen per year. Immediately after the disaster, the site was heavily contaminated. Fuel and graphite was spread around, and the radiation levels were critical. Most of the windows in the surrounding buildings were broken, and this glass and the building materials, nuclear fuel, and the graphite from the reactor littered the grounds. The material was collected by humans, robots, and industrial equipment. This heavy equipment was used to pile up the most contaminated of the debris and bury it in pits on site as a method of temporary storage. There wasn't enough time for them to manufacture or ship in new equipment to the site, so it wouldn't be uncommon for you to see various military vehicles like tanks running around during operations during those first few weeks. During the first 11 days, helicopters dropped over 14,000 tons of various materials, generally lead, dolomite, marble powder, sand, zeolite, anything that they could think of that would help stop the reaction from occurring. By the 11th day, the radiation releases from the reactor had dropped dramatically due to the heroic efforts of some workers who went underneath the reactor building and were pumping liquid nitrogen, which ultimately helped to cool some of this melted nuclear fuel. The radiation that was released was in the form of radioactive gases, as we can see in this picture, but it also included condensed particles and actual particles of the fuel and graphite itself. The intense heat of the core spiked to over 2,500 degrees Celsius, and it worked like a chimney here. As you can see, it pushed this plume upwards thousands of feet into the atmosphere, where it traveled from that point of dispersion and spread until it was easily detected throughout the northern hemisphere, leaving behind a trail of contamination in virtually every country in both Eastern and Western Europe. Because the release took place over a period of time, it was greatly affected by the weather conditions. So this map shows some of the different directions that this plume was pushed over this first 10-day period. This resulted in widespread contamination in every direction, with heavy deposits occurring in rainfall. But the mixture of radionuclides was not the same everywhere. In certain areas, you would see different compositions, and that's been very interesting to compare some of the international monitoring in Europe as they look at the radioactive materials that were spread. For the first few months after the explosions, workers carried out just emergency operations. By mid-May, the Soviet government concluded that they needed to construct some type of structure, some type of sarcophagus that would limit the release of radionuclides into the environment and lower the exposure of these workers that were on site trying to carry out these activities. The Soviet Ministry of Machine Building was the one that was assigned the task of designing this shelter. The sarcophagus was designed to prevent elements from getting into the reactor building and also to limit the things that were coming out. But it is not a closed structure. It was, there were purposeful openings that were left to allow some gases to get out, so that way there wasn't a buildup of pressure or temperature inside of the shelter. The design that they ultimately chose was selected out of 18 different styles that were proposed. And it was selected because it made the most use of the existing reactor building. And that added some complications down the road, and we'll touch on that as well. Each of the proposed designs all based their structural materials out of enormous amounts of concrete and metal. And this took a while to find the materials and to get them onto site. The radiation levels on site prevented humans from doing much of the work for very long, and there's a lot of stories that you can go out and hear about some of the heroic activities of people who walked out and physically picked up this fuel and graphite despite the radiation levels. But the sarcophagus is a sort of concrete and metal pyramid. The construction started from the ground up. The first thing that they had to do, this picture illustrates a lot of the debris that was spread across. This is the roof of the Unit 3 reactor building, and so you can see some of the damage up here on the south. This is the turbine building area, and you can see all around the grounds around the reactor building were littered with this debris. So once they began to push this material back into place, they began to construct these new protective walls that you see around the reactor building. And these retaining walls also held the poured concrete that they used around the base. The Unit 3 and Unit 4 reactors were back-to-back, side-by-side. They actually had to construct special walls between the Unit 3 operating room and the Unit 4 reactor just to lower the doses to the operators of that Unit 3 reactor. They also constructed what were called cascade walls, and you can see the beginning of them starting to creep up the reactor building. And this was a very precarious task. You can see these cranes, and this is when they're working at around the ground level, but as they began to move up, you see these cranes begin moving up the structure. And this is an interesting one. How would you like to be operating that crane with half of it hanging off of a ledge? So these new cascade walls were constructed around that crippled reactor building. They then installed a new cover and roof on the turbine building. But we talked about how the sarcophagus design incorporated the most of this existing structure. This is the western wall. So the turbine building is on this side. The Unit 3 reactor is on the back side of this. And the western wall holds a lot of the support for the roof of this structure. So they installed it piece by piece. They constructed these pieces off-site. This is one piece, and they trucked them in, lined them up, and then used a crane to push them into place. Now, on top of that, they installed this beam system here. And you can see it's resting on the concrete, the existing concrete of the reactor building. And on top of that, they placed these 1 meter diameter steel pipes, and they laid them horizontally north to south, and they were filled. They discussed filling them with concrete, but unfortunately, due to the weight that would add to the structure, they were not able to do that. So this is some pictures of them laying them across, and then on top of this is what they would support the steel panels that ultimately make up the shell. This is the mammoth beam. This is one of the largest beams that was used on the southern wall. And it just gives you an idea of how enormous of an operation this was, especially considering you couldn't work very long and you had obstructed views. There was debris everywhere. You couldn't just put the crane exactly where you wanted it. You had to find an area that wasn't so contaminated. While work above the ground focused on limiting the release of radiation from the reactor building, underground, workers toiled tirelessly to dig this tunnel under the reactor. The concern was that the melted nuclear fuels would penetrate through the reactor building into the ground, and there was some water underneath the building, and there was some concerns that this could cause an additional explosion, which would further spread the materials around the site. So these heroes, as I think of them, they toiled by hand with shovels and wheelbarrows, walking into a tunnel that looked much like a mine that went underneath this building. But the environmental conditions inside of this tunnel were beyond difficult. And oftentimes, these workers would remove their protective gear just to breathe a little bit better or move better. And it was an incredible work. The construction activities, while they were taking place, they went around the clock, 24 hours a day, with about 10,000 workers on each shift. These workers cleared the debris and contaminated materials from the north side of the Unit 4 building and the east side of the Unit 3 building. And additionally, they had to decontaminate the local area, scrape topsoil, build new roads. It was a very large undertaking just to get the materials on site, let alone to construct the sarcophagus. But the completed sarcophagus is a 300,000-ton, 28-story shelter object. And it is constructed out of lead, concrete, and steel, primarily, all of which is now extremely contaminated. It is important to remember that it has always been a temporary stopgap measure, not a permanent solution. In fact, in many places, they didn't even connect all of the different components of the structure because of the hazardous conditions. And they were installing these by crane, remotely, so it was a very difficult project, and it forced them to not take as many measures as they would have liked to construct this structure. But in 1988, Soviet scientists announced that the sarcophagus would only last 20 to 30 years. That was their guarantee on the building, before it would require extensive maintenance and rebuilding. The designers had to deal with many different complexities. There's a slide missing. One of the things that people don't recognize is exactly where the reactor is in the structure, but it's up off of the ground. It's not like when they wanted to go and respond to the reactor that they could just go and look in and look down. They actually had to go up a few stories to even get to the point where they could determine what was going on. The first picture that we're going to look at here is the inside of the Unit 3 Central Hall. This is the reactor building. There's the reactor here, and then back here is the spent fuel pools, and then hanging on the walls back here, they will have fresh fuel, which hasn't been put into the reactor yet. But this is how the reactor building should look. This is the inside of the Unit 4 Central Hall, or what remains of it. And the following pictures will help communicate some of the severity of the damage from these explosions. As workers explored the shelter object, they found areas which needed reinforcement and repair in order to improve the condition and stability of the shelter. To remediate the area around the reactor building, they picked up all of the pieces of fuel and graphite and removed the top layer of soil. After the accident, very little information was made about the disaster to the international community. But it has been estimated that up to 1 ton of nuclear fuel is covering the inside of the walls of the reactor building. So this has made its way out of the reactor, and this is just what's stuck on the walls. This is what's called Elena. This is the lid of the reactor. It is a biological shield. It is made out of concrete, and this was placed on top, and as you can see, the explosion completely displaced it. On top, these cones that you see are neutron detectors that they specially made and inserted to monitor if there was any ongoing criticality inside. By the 1990s, the Soviet Union realized that the sarcophagus was not a long-term structure. Despite all of the additional reinforcements, it no longer meets their national safety and security standards in the country of Ukraine. There's a few reasons for this. The dust and decomposition of fuel materials inside of the current shelter can still be suspended. And like I said, it's not a closed structure, so if they are resuspended, they can actually escape out into the environment. But also, it allows other environmental concerns, allowing water into the reactor building. So they proposed three new confinement structures: the frame, the console, and the arch. Underneath here, we have some of the structural dust and environmental concerns that they had to deal with when they were selecting this. Eventually, they decided to use the arch design, although if you go back and read, there was some controversy over that selection. While the construction was being discussed and the selection of the style was made, the workers on site conducted stabilization activities. They strengthened the foundations and the walls, as well as some of the roof of the structure. They fixed leaks. And even after so much time had gone by, they were still forced to endure radiation levels over 500 millirentgen per hour. This slide depicts the area of the current shelter and turbine building that will be covered by the new confinement structure as it's moved into place. It is an incredibly massive structure. It's described as the largest movable structure in the history of mankind. It is large enough that the Statue of Liberty could easily fit underneath it. They plan to move this new confinement structure in place over the sarcophagus in one day. The design engineer told me that the problem would not be getting the structure to move as much as it would be getting it to stop in the right place. Like the sarcophagus, the preparation for the new confinement structure started with creating places for work. The area had not been as decontaminated as you would have expected. They had to do a bunch of work to remove buried materials, and we will get to that. But this is the work pad which would ultimately be used for the construction of the new confinement structure. Over here on the left, this is a view from above the Unit 4 reactor. So you're looking out west. The city of Pripyat is over here. And this blue building right here, if I can get back to that. This blue building is called the sanatorium building. And this is where the workers arrive every day before they go on to the more contaminated areas. And this is where they change into their personal protection equipment and other gear that they wear. They needed to create the work pad not only to cut down on the dust and to reduce the worker exposures, but also to support the incredible weight of this new structure. The structure was constructed from top to bottom, and so these cranes right here jack it up, and as they complete each new section, it moves up and another section is installed underneath it. They also have to construct special tracks which will guide the structure in place over the Unit 4. So this is the corner of the turbine building, and this is workers who are now removing the soil and laying down the concrete for these tracks. This is actually one of the bases of the new confinement structure, and it will travel down this track this entire length. This is about as far as it will travel. This is a current view from underneath this new confinement structure looking at the Unit 4 sarcophagus. So this is about another view of how far it will have to travel. This yellow piece of equipment right here is one of the garrets that will be installed inside of this new confinement structure. And they will use that someday to begin dismantling the sarcophagus and hopefully begin removing some of the materials. These are movable panels. And when the sarcophagus is moved, they will be lifted, which will allow them to clear the existing structure. And then once it's on the other side, they will be lowered back again in place. Just some pictures to give you a size of the scale of this construction activity. The cranes that you see outside can easily fit inside of the new confinement structure. This is one of the hydraulic engines which we're going to be moving the equipment in place. Let's talk about the current site conditions. This is the Golden Corridor, the deaerator corridor, which connects the administration building to the control rooms. This is the the same corridor that workers would be rushing down to reach the end of the hallway, which is the Unit 4 reactor. If you've ever read some of the books, you probably have heard of this golden corridor, and that's this structure right here. This is a historic photo of the inside of the Unit 4 control room here. And this is how the Unit 2 control room looks today. This is how you would expect it to look. This is the current condition inside of the Unit 4 control room. You'll notice that many of these pieces of equipment are missing. They were scavenged for use at the other three reactors at the site after the disaster. It's a very, very dark, dusty room with only one light that you can see back here behind the control panels. This is the servo rod indicators. This is the control rod indicators. And as you can see, the control rod attached to this indicator was never fully inserted into the reactor. And these were the gauges that the operators would look at to determine whether or not these control rods had fully inserted. The hallways inside of the sarcophagus are dimly lit. In some areas, like this one pictured, you'll notice that plastic has been laid down over the floor to prevent the spread of dust and contamination. This is what the exterior of the sarcophagus looks like today. It is extremely unstable in engineering terms. You can see that additional scaffolding has been erected here along the western wall, which provides additional support and also helps to alleviate some of the weight of the roof on the reactor building, which is experiencing accelerated decay, not only because of the environmental conditions inside, but also the intense radioactive fields. The original stack, I'll make one more point. You'll notice the stack is no longer red and white. The original stack was so heavily contaminated that they had to remove it, and they've replaced it with this smaller yellow and white design, and it was a visible difference that we noticed when we were on site. But the site today is essentially an industrial construction site. There are piles of material and gravel. There's equipment lined up in certain areas, and there are lots of trucks and equipment moving about the site. The picture that we are looking at right here is the unit, the turbine building, which if you remember, you might have heard in 2013, there was a collapse of some of the portions of this structure, and they are still working to repair it. In fact, in my discussions with the supervisor who's overseeing this construction, they actually noted that they were not planning on necessarily repairing that portion of the turbine building because it would have been covered by this new confinement structure when it was moved in place. However, the international outcry was strong enough that it forced them to kind of change their activities, and they are still working on repairing that portion of the structure. This is the ABK-1 administration building. And underneath it, what's very interesting, this is the evacuation shelter where all of the administrators were hiding out during the early phases of the accident. This room is one of the few sleeping rooms that were provided, and this is where some of the emergency workers and miners would go to get rest in between shifts if they could not leave the site. They are not comfortable beds. It's essentially a piece of plywood with a little bit of foam and a covering over top of it. The whole thing is about an inch thick. This is the headquarters of this evacuation shelter. This desk right here is where all the plant supervisors would sit, and the plant director would be back over here. This is the interim spent fuel storage facility. So you had four reactors that were operating that were all generating spent fuel, and we have recovered that spent fuel out of three of the reactors. Obviously, we have not from Unit 4. This is the building that they have constructed to house those materials in the interim. But it's not a long-term solution, and so they have to process these materials and put them in a method that's more easy for them to control in the intermediate to long-term period. So this is a new structure that they are building, and this is a dry cask storage facility right next to it. So this new structure that they would be using it for is to take the spent fuel and to put it into dry casks and then load these dry casks into this storage area. So far, we've only talked about the radioactive materials in and around the reactor building, but there are many critical issues to deal with in the adjacent areas as well. Remember, we discussed that in the early days, the workers were trying to clear the contaminated equipment and materials as quickly as possible. They weren't concerned about the long-term implications of these actions. So as a result, you're left with a bunch of contaminated equipment both above and below the surface of the ground. There's actually an interesting story. One of my friends is the supervisor who is doing some of these activities, and they were digging in an area for this trench that we talked about that will move the new confinement structure in place. And all of a sudden, these pipes came up out of the ground with the dirt that they were lifting out, and the radiation level spiked, so they stopped work, and it ultimately ended up being some of the zirconium cladding for the fuel assemblies that they had pulled out of the ground. So this is the type of stuff that they are still finding. They don't know where all of it is. Another issue that they're going to have to deal with is the construction of storage facilities for contaminated material and nuclear waste. One thing that a lot of people don't consider is that at some point, Chernobyl will ultimately turn up into a long-term disposal facility for the radioactive materials from this accident. They will not leave the site. And I expect that this is likely the same future in some capacity that they will face in Japan as well. One of the critical issues at the power plant today is to keep worker exposures as low as possible. But if we're honest, there's only so much that can be done. We're never going to be able to fully remove the risk of working at a site like Chernobyl or Fukushima. There are multiple exposure concerns, but one of the primary ones is the spread of dust and the accumulation of dust on the clothes of workers. So around the site, you will see these little metal trays filled with water. They are also in front of the buildings, and as you walk through every tray in your path to prevent some of this material from building up on your shoes. There's the other risk of exposure is the gamma rays that are coming out of the sarcophagus, and it is inescapable. If you are in the vicinity, your radiation levels will be affected, determined by how far you are from that sarcophagus, what's between you. So what they have done is they have installed different types of methods of reducing this dose from the gamma shine. You'll notice these lead structures here, and this is a concrete viewing box. And what we noticed is we were able to take our equipment with us on site, and we noticed that in the immediate vicinity behind these lead shields, so right where they're standing, it offered about a 50% reduction in the gamma shine. But that obviously decreased the farther away you moved back from those. These little concrete shelters is something that a supervisor will use. And they will go in there, if they're overseeing some activities or they want to closer inspect an area, they'll put one of these boxes in there, and you can go inside and there will be a viewing hole that you can look out through the other side and hopefully lower some of the exposure to the rest of your body. Another thing that they have done in front of the scaffolding, so this is the scaffolding that they used to resecure the roof of the existing structure, but they have built this concrete wall here. And this is just another method of attempting to lower the worker doses so that for workers who are working in these areas, they will not be experiencing the same levels that they would without them. These are the radiation monitoring portals, and these are scattered throughout the site in every building. When you come in or you go out, you have to pass through one of these monitors, and they have a great training video. If you notice, your hands and feet have to be in the appropriate places, and they have some pretty interesting training videos of people who were trying to get through this equipment but without using it correctly. We're going to slide through some of these for time constraints. And let's talk about the cooling pond. Before the disaster, the 2.5-mile-long cooling pond at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant was a popular fishing spot and supported a large fish farm. Again, this is Kyiv, and up here you can actually see the cooling pond from space. And over here I have a larger picture for you. This cooling pond was heavily contaminated during the disaster, and pieces of nuclear fuel were directly introduced into it. Water from the underground compartments of the reactor was directly pumped into the cooling pond by fire trucks. Additionally, they also scraped heavily contaminated soils and dumped them into certain areas of this cooling pond. And over time, the majority of these radioactive materials began to settle out and accumulate in the bottom sediments. And this is a concern, because now that there are no operating reactors at the site, there is no need for a cooling pond. It is a man-made cooling pond, and if they were not to manage the water levels, down here is the amount of water that would be left behind if they just let it be. And that would expose a large amount of these radioactive materials. These illustrations, this is cesium, strontium, and plutonium levels in the bottom of this cooling pond. So there is some concern about what they should do. Do we scrape everything out and allow it to dry? Do we cement? Do we put down tarps? Or do we just keep water in it? But they are experiencing some drought conditions and a lack of snowfall in the winter for the last few years that is affecting the water levels in this cooling pond. So it is becoming a much more pressing risk and concern to them. We're going to touch really quickly on the city of Pripyat, which for all intents and purposes is barely recognizable as a city anymore. We were walking down the sidewalks along one of the major streets here, and you can't see many of the structures from the street. These structures are now falling apart after 30 years of not being adequately maintained, and there is an order right now which discourages or prevents people from entering these structures because they are concerned about them collapsing on them. This building right here behind the bushes, this is the hospital in Pripyat where many of the emergency responders and first victims were brought before they were transferred to Moscow. This is the inside of the hospital, and it has been left largely the way it was when they evacuated the city. It was a beautiful city. It was full of art. It was full of murals. It was full of beautiful painted glass, all of which today is decaying and fading. The exclusion zone around the nuclear power plant acts as a method of institutional control to prevent the public from accessing many of these most highly contaminated lands. 50% of the land in 1986 in this exclusion zone was forested, and now more than 70% of that land is forested. This is pictures from Chernobyl City, and these are some of the monuments and memorials of the disaster. One of them that was most striking to me was this avenue of signs with big red lines through the names. We would find out that these are the names of the towns in the exclusion zone that had to be permanently evacuated because of the release of radiation. And I can tell you it is very powerful to see them lined up in front of you. The contamination in these exclusion zones and areas around the nuclear power plant is very complex and challenging. It's not consistent. Radiation levels vary enormously according to where the radioactive material fell, with some parts showing radiation levels typical to what you would see here in some areas. Some parts are thousands of times higher. And I did some sampling in some of these areas that had higher levels and lower levels. And even in the lower areas where the exposure levels were lower than some areas here in the U.S., when we analyzed that soil in the lab, we were still able to find strontium and cesium and other radioactive materials in there that would be taking up into the plant life, that could be internalized by people working in that area. The major concern right now is with the forest fires that are happening in the area. It is impossible for them to remediate these forests. There have been a few attempts, but they have all failed. So the countermeasures that they have put in place is they restrict access to these areas. But the problem is that there is a big risk of fires. According to a study published in 2014 by Dr. Timothy Mousseau, decomposers and other types of insects that drive this process of decay in these forested areas have been affected by the radiation levels. And this is complicating the decay of the materials back into the soil, leading to increased fire risk. According to simulations produced by Dr. Mousseau, previous forest fires up until 2014 had re-released and redispersed approximately 8% of the radiation from the original catastrophe. I would really like to talk about the workers at Chernobyl. Today, more than 3,500 men and women who work at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant every day live here, and this is the city of Slavutich. The city of Slavutich has I believe between 20 and 30,000 people currently residing in it, and like I said, about 3,500 people on site at the nuclear power plant every day. They take these trains from the city of Slavutich here. This is the train, and it dead ends at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. So you jump on, and it is not uncommon to see workers grabbing a last little bit of rest on their way back and forth from the nuclear power plant. This is the station at the nuclear power plant where the train arrives. And as the workers leave the train, they walk through some radiation monitoring portals into their locker rooms where they change into their work clothes. This is the sanatorium building, which is where they dress in their heavy protective equipment. We're going in the high radiation areas of the site. They employ what's called the clean line principle. So you'll notice this red line right here. On this side of the line, you can wear shoes. On this side of the line, you can't wear shoes. And it is a method of preventing some of this transfer of dust inside of the structure. The workers on site right now carry out a bunch of different activities, mostly related to the construction of this new confinement structure. This is one of the dosimetrists who's inspecting a shipload of material that was removed from the site for radiation levels. But the workers at the plant today are not the same workers that were there 30 years ago. It is their children. It is their nieces, their nephews. It is the next generation, which has already begun to take over a lot of these construction activities. So the problem there is that the workers, it's a generational problem at this point. It is easier for someone to get a job at the plant if a member of their family has worked at the plant easier. This is one of my favorite gentlemen. I will never forget him. We were just coming out of the Unit 4 reactor building, and we were outside of that big blue sanatorium building that you saw, and there was a large number of workers who were milling about the site. And this gentleman, as I had my camera with us, he had this big, beaming, I would say almost a Western smile, which is very abnormal for that region. And I was trying to get a picture of him, and I just couldn't get him to turn just right. Well, his buddies saw what I was trying to do. And so without any type of communication, one of them reached out, grabbed his head, turned it toward me, and I got probably one of my favorite pictures of this entire trip. So let's talk about what still lies in store for Chernobyl in the future. At some indeterminate point in time, the sarcophagus will need to be dismantled. As the sarcophagus ages, it changes, and it becomes more hazardous over time. As one worker told me, the sarcophagus used to be a symbol of accomplishment, but very quickly it turned into a source of concern and controversy. They're going to have to decommission the Unit 1, Unit 2, Unit 3 reactors. They're going to have to deal with the cooling pond. They're going to have to deal with the radioactive material and melted fuel inside of the Unit 4 reactor building. One of the things that people don't think about is that if you have 3,500 workers on site every day, that's a lot of laundry. And they have to do all of this laundry on site. And they sort the clothes based on the radiation levels. They process them. But this generates more waste. All of the activities seemingly produce their own type of waste, which is going to have to be dealt with at some point down the road. We are running out of time, but I want to just stop and talk to you a little bit about these workers. For me, my visit to Chernobyl, it made me more compassionate. In America, it can be hard to interact with people outside of our personal space, let alone a different country. One of the things that was impressed upon me is that the workers at Chernobyl, they are kin to us. They are friends. What does it mean to be a friend? I wrote down a couple thoughts. Friendship forms often out of people who have common goals. We have a common goal with the workers at Chernobyl in that we want to see that site handled appropriately. But a friend is someone who you trust and who trusts you. And a friend is someone who would sacrifice their life and happiness for you. My discussion with these workers on site, I never met one who said that he wanted to work somewhere else. They all feel very strongly, from the supervisors down to the people who are actually removing the materials. I felt that I asked them in a way that it would allow them to communicate to me if they had concerns about the site. This gentleman right here is my friend Anton, who is our primary liaison with the nuclear power plant. We are both of similar age and lifestyle, and we really bonded on my time during the trip there. When I think of the power plant, I can't forget people like Anton. On the last day of my trip, I was trying to find out what can I do to help the workers, not explain things, but that can have an impact on these workers. And I was speaking with Anton. He grabbed my hand and he looked me squarely in the face and he told me, just tell people the truth. Tell them the good and the bad. That's the best that you can do. That's the best that you can do for us. And that's exactly what I try to do as I explain this to you all. So thank you for having me. I look forward to hearing from Dr. Fields next.